Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. I'm joined here by my co-host, Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina. Our guest is Dr. Adam Hirsch, the first author on a paper about prescriptions for antibiotics that result from pediatric ambulatory visits in the U.S. It appeared online in Pediatrics last month. Dr. Hirsch is an assistant professor of pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Welcome to Clinical Conversations.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You used federal data to examine over 60,000 pediatric ambulatory care visits. Is it fair to say that we're still overprescribing antibiotics for kids in the U.S.?
I think that's a fair statement. I think there's two important messages that we learned from and confirmed from this study. One is that it is important to acknowledge and give credit to a lot of hard work that's happened over the last two decades around raising awareness of this problem, raising awareness about the fact that antibiotics are overused. And a lot of time, money, and effort has gone into bringing that problem to light. And in fact, there have been some very significant declines in the extent to which antibiotics are prescribed for both children and adults in the United States over the last two decades. And that's actually really good news, and that's important to know about, to highlight, and to look at carefully, because it's important to try to understand what led to those changes, what was effective. But with that said, it is abundantly clear that antibiotics remain seriously overprescribed in children and among adults. And this is a problem that it's a hard problem to tackle, but it's an important, really important global health problem at this point. And the second major message that, you know, that we are trying to draw attention to is that although there have been declines in antibiotic use that are significant, the kinds of antibiotics that are being used in 2011 for children and for adults too, are what we describe as broad-spectrum antibiotics. Increasingly, there's more and more attraction to using broad-spectrum antibiotics, and there's a number of reasons why that's the case, but that's a problem because these drugs are expensive, and they kill more of the good bacteria in our bodies than some of the older, cheaper, narrower-spectrum antibiotics. Mm-hmm. So they cause more problems in terms of breeding resistant infections.
And just like you said, I mean, this message is not brand new news to most doctors that were overusing antibiotics, but I was also very impressed by the fact that, you know, half of the prescriptions written for antibiotics were a broad spectrum. I mean, I found that number remarkably high.
We were surprised. It was one of the research questions that we had when we undertook this project was, you know, we knew we weren't doing a study of what's happened over time. A lot of these data sets that we work with have been used extensively to understand temporal patterns, time mm-hmm. trends. We wanted snapshot data. We wanted to know what's going on right now, and in particular, one of the things we wanted to figure out was what flavors of antibiotics are being chosen right mm-hmm. now, and what's the mix. And just as you said, you know, half or slightly over half of the antibiotics that are being chosen are broad-spectrum antibiotics. And it's really clear that in many instances, though broad-spectrum antibiotics are not
needed,
necessary,
yeah,
and are
right.
not adding anything extra. Now, you know, we can talk about why the attraction to those drugs, why they may be being used, and there's a number
most
of
which
reasons.
Are logistics and not microbiologics.
I think there's a number of factors. You know, one is logistics. I mean, a lot of the fancier broad-spectrum antibiotics have real advantages. They're mm-hmm. dosed. They need to be dosed less frequently. A great example
right.
is azithromycin, or
yeah.
it goes by the trade name Zithromax,
mm-hmm.
Once a day for 5 days.
Oh, it's
that's
it's
a heck of a lot
thing.
Better than two
yeah.
or three times a day for 10 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
Side effect profiles of some of the broad-spectrum antibiotics, including azithromycin and some of the fluoroquinolone drugs, some of the advanced cephalosporins, they actually have really nice side effect profiles. You avoid the issue of penicillin allergy, which is over-assigned. We know that, but a lot of patients, you know, sort of carry that label. Those are issues. And the other issue, too, is in some instances, docs may really have concerns that the infection that they're trying to treat is perhaps a drug-resistant infection or maybe resistant to some of the narrower spectrum drugs. And so some of the reason and some of the attraction may be because of concerns about resistance. In most cases, those concerns are unfounded. But in some cases, it's appropriate. So, but it's hard. This is a day-to-day challenge that a lot of frontline docs are dealing with.
And I noticed one of the independent risk factors for receiving broad-spectrum antibiotics was having private insurance. And so it does make you wonder if privately insured parents are more likely to come to the office sort of already knowing what they want. And, you know, this parental pressure, it seems like there has to be something to that. What can you recommend that providers do with this parental pressure?
Yeah, it's speculation, but I agree with you that that's to the extent that insurance is a proxy for it can indicate a number of things. It could be a proxy for something about how much the family or parents know about the medical system and know about medicines and how internet savvy they may be, for instance. It's also a proxy, though, for co-pays and what out-of-pocket costs are going to be. So there's probably two things that may be at work there. You know, at some level, having insurance may mean that the family is going to have less to pay out-of-pocket than, say, an uninsured patient where the doc may actually just say, I think the patient needs an antibiotic, but I want to give them the cheapest possible alternative. Which may be every bit as good as the fancier, more expensive option. But in regards to what to discuss with families, I think it's a bit of a broken record, but it is really important. We know pretty darn well for a lot of the conditions that are receiving treatment. Number one, that the older, less expensive, narrower spectrum antibiotics are every bit as good, and in some cases actually better, for treating the most common infections that children have. And I'll use an example, amoxicillin as compared to azithromycin. If your number one concern is effectiveness, for the average kid who has an ear infection, 100 times out of 100 you should be choosing amoxicillin over azithromycin. There is actually a lot of resistance to azithromycin in 2011, and there's very low resistance in most communities to amoxicillin. So for the condition that is the number one driver of antibiotic use in pediatrics, and that's ear infections, the best drug is the oldest and cheapest drug we have. And so I think really emphasizing that message, and that's one of the important messages that we have, that the Infectious Disease Society of America is trying to emphasize, that the Pediatric Infectious Disease Society is trying to emphasize to the community of care providers, and that this message in turn really should be communicated to families, that just because it's old and just because it's cheap, it's still the best drug. And that's what matters.
I was talking with a physician who was trying to explain the craziness of all this, and he said that when his patients come in with the kid's got an upper respiratory infection that's clearly viral, and they want an antibiotic, he says, "Well, I can either wave a rubber chicken over your child's head, or I can prescribe an antibiotic. They'll have the same results." And
well, it's true, and this is, you brought before the issue of parental expectations, and one thing to comment, this it's related to this research study, but I think it's it gets into work that other people have done, is that I do think that one thing that has been shown is that doctors believe that patients want antibiotics, and doctors believe that more than it is actually true.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's been shown over and over again that misunderstandings of expectations between the doctor and the patient and the patient's family occur. The result is an antibiotic prescription when the doctor didn't really think that the antibiotic prescription was necessary, and actually the patient and family didn't necessarily require it to be satisfied.
Yeah.
And that's an issue. And I think there are changes in social and cultural norms that are occurring now, and I think that's actually an important factor in why we've seen a decline in antibiotic use. One of the things that's important and that we've learned from using these federal databases is that the amount of antibiotics that are prescribed has declined.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to get overly mathematical here, but what hasn't declined is the percentage of office visits that result in an antibiotic prescription. So about 1 in 5 office visits in pediatrics, antibiotic prescription.
Mm-hmm.
That has not changed over 20 years. What has changed is the amount of office visits for respiratory conditions. So people have changed the way and their tendency to seek care for mild upper respiratory tract infections. And I think it's important to acknowledge that patients and families deserve some credit for this trend. I think in the medical community, there's been a lot of emphasis on, oh, look, we've successfully changed doctors' prescribing habits and doctors' prescribing behavior. And we may have. But in so doing, what may have also resulted, and I think is very important, is that, a lot of families, and in the case of pediatrics, parents of a young child, their kid has a runny nose, maybe even has a fever, they've learned that that doesn't necessarily require a trip to the doctor's office for an antibiotic.
Yeah, that does make sense.
That's a huge driver.
There were some regional factors at work here as well. For instance, compared with Western states, and you're in a Western state, Dr. Hirsch, clinicians in the South are much more likely to write the prescription. So this is another, would you say, cultural factor?
It's a really interesting area. I mean, I think more broadly, even than just this conversation, is geographic variation in healthcare delivery and how people practice.
Mm-hmm.
It has been shown. This isn't the first study to show that antibiotic prescribing rates seem to differ geographically, and at least in children, the South region of the United States has been shown to have a higher rate of antibiotic prescribing as compared to other regions. And it's not that well understood why these differences may exist. Some of it may be due to density of patients, density of children, and there may be some real reasons medically why there may be differences, but surely some of it is cultural. Speculation here, but we know that very aggressive efforts at the state level have occurred in the Mountain West and in the Western states about raising awareness around antibiotic overuse, both to physicians and actually directly to patients and families. And we know that these sort of social marketing campaigns
mm-hmm.
are very effective. And it's clear that that these programs have occurred with more intensity in certain regions of the United States, and that may be part of why we see differences.
Hmm.
There could also be issues like insurance coverage and how co-pays, things like that may vary geographically as well.
And this may be slightly off topic. You're welcome to say no comment, but. What do you think about the role of other interventions such as diagnostic testing like procalcitonin or antibiotic stewardship programs? Just you mentioned that in your article as well.
Because
we've
totally
used these on the inpatient side. endlessly, but it seems like those are less utilized on the outpatient arena.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really important and on topic kind of, well, okay, here's a problem, so what can we do about it? I mean,
mm-hmm,
I think
mm-hmm.
it is important to acknowledge, and I do want to acknowledge this, that, you know, being a frontline pediatrician is really hard. And although doctors who take care of children see kids with upper respiratory tract infections a lot, it doesn't mean the fact that they see these kids frequently doesn't make it any easier to make a diagnosis. It's
mm-hmm.
actually, you know, diagnosing otitis media is, in many cases, is really hard,
mm-hmm.
Even for someone who has a lot of experience.
Right.
So this is hard, and I think where a lot of antibiotic overuse occurs is in the gray area for kids where there's diagnostic uncertainty. And I think
right.
diagnostic uncertainty leads to conservative kind of decision-making. So number one, developing better diagnostic tests to help raise certainty and reduce uncertainty is an incredibly important strategy for the future. And you mentioned procalcitonin, and that certainly has what appears to be an emerging role for hospitalized patients in determining who doesn't need, this patient's sick, but they actually don't need to be, they don't have an infection, and they don't need antibiotics. In outpatient and ambulatory care, where things are going, and it's really exciting, actually, is in rapid molecular diagnostics for viral respiratory pathogens. And we've had for a long time pretty good tests for viruses like flu, like influenza and RSV.
Mm-hmm.
Though recently, as everybody knows, the rapid tests for influenza are not so good. And we learned that, you know, really starkly during 2009, during the H1N1 pandemic. But there's a lot of investment and technology right now in developing really accurate point-of-care molecular diagnostic tests. That can be used in emergency departments and in primary care doctors' offices. Now, a lot of primary care docs don't have much in the way of rapid diagnostic tools available to them. There's rapid strep tests, really, really helpful.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea is if we could have a tool that worked that same way for viruses, it would be very helpful in making an assessment of a child who has fever but, you know, is not unwell, but has fever and other upper respiratory tract infections. And if you could name a virus that kid has, you know, a lot of us believe that would be a helpful strategy to reduce the amount of unnecessary antibiotic use. Antibiotic stewardship, another important area, really taking off in hospitals and really effective. And that, of course, involves really careful scrutiny of basically every antibiotic prescription that's occurring. In a closed environment like a hospital, it's
a lot easier.
It's doable. It's not even in the same way. It's not feasible to have a pharmacist reviewing or an infectious disease doctor reviewing every single antibiotic prescription in ambulatory care because there's so many of them. But things like computerized decision support, things like formulary restrictions, you know, getting back to this issue around broad and narrow spectrum antibiotics, there's really, for a lot of docs, you know, there's no disincentive to prescribe broader, more expensive, but no less effective antibiotics because the formularies allow it. And you know, that's a strategy that's been used in the hospital setting to actually effectively reduce unnecessary antibiotic use, basically, you know, forcing someone to really justify why you're going to use a drug for a particular infection. You know, an example would be an ear infection or a sinus infection, where you'd say, you know, the default option is the really good, cheap, narrow-spectrum drug like amoxicillin or amoxiclav. And if you want to use something fancier than that, you've got to go through some hoops and justify it. And, you know, in a busy office practice, that sometimes
can be ornery.
Really, really onerous. But we've got a public health crisis with antibiotic overuse and the attendant consequences. And that really needs to be addressed. You know, in the bigger picture, the issue is the simultaneous epidemics of antibiotic overuse, of the development of multi-drug-resistant infections, mm-hmm. all occurring at the same time as a huge decline in the development of new drugs to treat mm-hmm. these resistant infections. So we've got all these sort of simultaneous forces, and you know, we really have to, in some cases, start thinking more broadly about strategies to reduce unnecessary antibiotic use. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, something like formulary restriction sounds really draconian and onerous, right. but it's an area that I think bears some consideration. Yep. Another area, too, you know, that we talk a lot about in pediatrics, and it sounds so kind of old-fashioned, but, you know, again, if a lot of antibiotic overuse is occurring in the context of diagnostic uncertainty, one of the solutions to that issue is to do a better job training pediatricians as clinical diagnosticians. And that is an area of clinical training that I think a lot of people believe is eroding is a dying focus. And, you know, I think at the top of antimicrobial stewardship strategies, you know, principle number one is be a good diagnostician. Yeah. And if you're a good diagnostician, you will be a more judicious prescriber of antibiotics. And so, you know, it sounds sort of old and crotchety to talk about that, but I think it's a hugely important strategy in facing these problems.
I wanted to ask if there was one book or one thing that our listeners could read or other than listen to this podcast that would help them get a better frame around this problem.
Absolutely. I'll mention several. Okay. The Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, has two programs that I think are really important to highlight, and they're called the Get Smart programs, and they have terrific websites. There's one that's called Get Smart for Antibiotics, mm-hmm. and that focuses on the problem of antibiotic overuse and offers a lot of resources and tools for doctors to try to deal with this issue, whether it's patient education materials, whether it's treatment guidelines, algorithms, etc. So I think that's a terrific resource that I really do want to highlight.
And I will put that online
that
on
would
our
be
website.
Fabulous. The companion sister program is called Get Smart for Healthcare. And the Get Smart for Healthcare, so the Get Smart for Antibiotics program focuses on outpatient antibiotic use. The Get Smart for Healthcare program focuses on inpatient antibiotic use and specifically puts a lot of emphasis on the importance of antimicrobial stewardship programs mm-hmm. and highlights things like highlights, number one, the value of these programs, and also has a lot of resources about how to develop a program, how to set up a program, and what are key aspects of a program. So those are terrific resources to look at. You mentioned things to read. There's a book by an infectious disease doctor at UCLA named Brad Spellberg called The Rising Plague. And he's an infectious disease expert who studies antibiotic resistant infections. The book is written for the public, but it really highlights some of these issues about the simultaneous epidemics of antibiotic resistant infections occurring in this context of a dwindling supply of new drugs, mm-hmm. and looks at the disincentives that actually exist for pharmaceutical companies to develop new antimicrobials. They're not blockbuster drugs, mm-hmm. And for that reason, they're not necessarily worth a lot of investment. There are some important things going on in D.C. right now, in particular something called the GAIN Act, and the GAIN Act is a
GAIN Act.
Yeah, GAIN, and it stands for generating, just make sure I, generating antibiotic incentives now.
Okay.
And it is, it was introduced in the House, I think this spring. And what it is a series of proposals to generate incentives for the development of new antibiotics and antimicrobials more broadly. Things like offering extended patent periods, things like in patent exclusivity, and really trying to bring greater attention to this issue, because this is an issue that this isn't fear mongering. This is, you know, superbug. There's been fear mongering that has occurred around,
yeah,
you know, with the,
yeah,
use of the term superbug, etc.
Right.
But the problem of running out of antibiotics to treat antibiotic resistant infections is not fear mongering. It,
yeah,
takes on average at least 10 years to develop a new drug,
yeah,
from the time of, you know, good idea to, you know, FDA approval. That process is maybe too onerous for the public health needs. So, you know, other things in the GAIN Act also talk about ways to potentially accelerate that process.
Yeah.
And as a pediatrician,
yeah,
you know, the other issue too, of course, for children is, you know, you get a new drug to market, you don't necessarily have good data about how to dose the drug for little babies.
Oh, sure.
And so that's, you know, so any delays, you know, if there's a 10-year delay in developing a new drug for an adult, the delay may be even further for a child.
All right. Well, Dr. Hirsch, I want to thank you for spending the time with us today. I know we've gone a little bit over what you expected, and we do appreciate that.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Happy to talk about this stuff.
That was our 138th edition. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. This podcast comes to you from Journal Watch, an excellent way to keep up with clinical research whose implications affect how you practice every day. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer, thank you for listening.